This morning I talked about awareness and using awareness and mindfulness as a way to move into our spiritual life, our relationship with Christ. And this afternoon, I really want to look at our relationship with other people. You know, I have a favorite expression. I did not coin it, but we are going to be looking at what I call hospitality of the heart. Hospitality of the heart. Learning to make room in our hearts for other people. And again, it will be using the same awareness and mindfulness that we spoke of this morning as we look at this issue. Hospitality of the heart can be practiced in any place, in any situation, in any mode of life. And it's really the core of relationships. We reflect a lot on hospitality in our monastery, and Father mentioned that he felt maybe we had a special bent toward providing hospitality to priests and their wives as a respite. We do, but that's not where we begin or end. Hospitality is the major work of our monastery, second only to prayer, both prayer in the church and personal prayer of each of the nuns. And this hospitality, what I'm talking about, God willing, people feel when they come to our monastery. And as an aside, I did put brochures for our monastery, our journal, Life Transfigured, in the back on the counter. I already forgot your name. I'm so bad with names. Bob. I asked Bob to put a little notebook in the back for those of you that like to be on our mailing list. You can put your name and address and your email address, and we'll do that for you. And I think I already mentioned about the prayer lists that are in the back as well. So hospitality is something that we work at the monastery, and I think you'll understand it better as I talk more about it. I want to say something about what hospitality is not. You know, for most of us, hospitality has been reduced to Martha Stewart, to the latest ideas for entertaining family and friends and decorating, or to the services of the hotel and the restaurant industry, like the Hilton hospitality. So as a result, even as Christians, we miss the significance of hospitality, and we view it as something pleasant that would be nice to do if we had the time. You're very unfair to sit behind me. You're going to be making me do this. You've noticed that I try to have some eye contact with people. Thank you, Father Deacon. And I would say to you that hospitality is very far from any of those things. It is not something that we do only when we have time for it, and it's not something that's just nice. Hospitality has biblical basis, for sure. When you look at the Old Testament, it's just full of accounts of hospitality. You have Abraham and Sarah who welcomed the three strangers and the lengths that they went to provide hospitality. I mean, you know, in those days, when Abraham said, fix something to eat, his wife didn't run to the kitchen, pull it out of the freezer, stuff it in the microwave, and have it in, you know, an hour. When you offered hospitality then, it was arduous, it was work. Nonetheless, they did it, and as a result of that hospitality, they were in direct contact with the Lord and were granted a son. We know that Elijah, when he was in need, went to the widow of Zarephath, asked that she feed him. She did, and she and her son had enough food, enough flour and wine to withstand a famine. We know that Elisha met the Shunammite woman, a married woman, who felt the need to extend hospitality to him, even to the point where she created an upper room where he could plan on staying when he was in the area. And out of that, she was granted a child. And when that child, as we know, when that child became ill and died, it was through the intercession of the prophet that the child was restored to health. In the law and the prophets in the Old Testament, there are exhortations to care for the stranger, to open our hearts, our homes, and resources to vulnerable ones. And the people of God themselves were identified as sojourners and aliens. So it's a deep reminder of our dependence on God and of our responsibility to deal graciously with the literal and non-literal aliens in our own community. In the New Testament, we're given a really interesting way to view hospitality. Our Lord himself was both the guest and the host. Jesus knew how to be dependent on others for his needs, his material needs, and I would venture to say because he was a man, for his needs for warmth and personal contact with those who followed him. And we know that he was startlingly gracious in his welcome to outsiders, to seekers, sinners, and we have therefore this wonderful model, this double model of being a host, providing hospitality, and receiving hospitality. And that's going to be critical to what I want to talk about today, because so often when we think hospitality, we think we're the provider, and we don't see ourselves as receiving in any way. We know that meals were central to Jesus' ministry, and that a shared meal soon became the center point of Christian worship after his death. Paul urged Christians to welcome one another as they would welcome Christ himself, and he challenged early believers to pursue hospitality. And in fact, it was a qualification for leadership in the early church, this offering of hospitality. In Hebrews, in the letter to the Hebrews, we're urged to offer hospitalities to strangers as Abraham and Sarah did, that we might also entertain angels. So hospitality to strangers is not just something from the Old Testament, it's something that we're exhorted to do in the New Testament as well. Now I want to take a look in a very different way at a parable that we have presented to us each year right before Lent begins in one of those pre-Sundays. It's the rich man and Lazarus. I think most of us remember that parable where the rich man fed on fine fare every day while Lazarus lay outside his home with sores and having nothing to eat. Well, this parable really touched my heart, and in a way that I never would have expected. But I would say to you that we can't really distance ourselves from this rich man. We have to be able to see ourselves as this rich man. And why? Well, I think we put a wedge between him and us as soon as we say, well, you know, he was really evil, he was really sinful. You know, you can make up in your mind all these things that went on for the rich man, how he could be so utterly awful. I would say to you, he's not utterly awful. He's simply unmindful and unaware. We know nothing more about him other than he feasted sumptuously and was rich. Scripture really, everything else we think we know about this rich man, we know because we've extrapolated in our minds what he must have been like. And I would say to you that it's just as likely that whatever his faults were, in this parable, obviously he's not a real person, that he lacked generosity not just of his goods, but of his heart. Of his heart. He may not have even noticed Lazarus. He may simply have just walked by him. He was like a fixture outside, and he may have just walked by. And that's another example of a crystalline look at a parable. There are many things about that parable. I'm choosing one little facet that will help us focus on this afternoon's topic. And that is that this rich man may have not cultivated mindfulness and awareness, and it led to him ignoring Lazarus. So what is this hospitality and what does it look like? I would say to you that hospitality is the means that we use to take people into the space in our own lives, our minds, and our hearts, and our efforts. It involves compassion. It involves empathy. It is the way that we live out the steadfast love, compassion, persistent and unconditional tenderness that we talked about this morning in relation to God and how he deals with us. We are formed in the likeness and the image of God, and we are exhorted to become like God. You know, the fathers tell us that's the goal of the Christian life, this deification, this becoming like God. Well, yeah, it may be lots of things, but if it doesn't have compassion, empathy, steadfast love, persistent and unconditional tenderness, then it's not real, because that's who God is. So hospitality is a way of coming out of ourselves, taking down barriers, turning the world around one heart at a time. And that's really hard for us in a sense. You know, we would like to change the world. We would like to get rid of so many things in the world. Torture, war, famine, sickness, all these big things. And we struggle with how that could ever come about. And I would say to you that one heart at a time. We may not have the answers to the big problem, but we're part of the problem when we don't engage in this kind of hospitality, this living out of God's life in our own life. So hospitality is not so much a task as it is a way of life, a way of life. And you know, it really is immediately felt and puts others at ease. When I was a small child, my family, my extended family, lived in New York. We lived in Washington, D.C. And when we went to New York, we visited relatives, but also very dear family friends, you know, people that you call aunt and uncle, but they're really not. And my strongest memories of being a small child and going to New York with my family was the incredible welcome that I got from these people. I was Lillian's daughter, and boy, was I special. Hugs, kisses, sit down, have something to eat. Food was prepared. They couldn't bring out enough food and cookies and I don't know what. And you just knew that you were special. You knew it. And it felt so darn good. It felt really good. Good enough that all these years later, I can remember these people's names that were not close to me. We saw them on occasion when we went visiting. But I can recall their names. I can recall what their houses looked like. And I really can recall what it felt like. And I would venture to say that if you all dug into your past somewhere, there would be someone, at least someone, who made you feel that way, that you knew loved you, didn't have to know everything about you. They loved you because of who you were. They loved me because I was Lillian's daughter. And if I did nothing else in life, that would be enough. I knew I was loved and I was treasured. That is irreplaceable. It's simply irreplaceable. And the fact that we have to dig back to find those times and really put ourselves in a position of remembering is very sad. Very sad. Hospitality of the heart accepts others as they are, recognizes them, and honors them. It allows them, as I said, to make themselves at home in our heart. We can make a place there for them. So a generous heart is such a big part of hospitality. It's not just being generous with our money. Yes, that's important. I'm not putting that away. But it's being generous with our love, our encouragement, our possessions, and our time. Because it's said, and I really believe this, that we can give without loving, but we can't love without giving. And the corollary to that is that a little becomes much if we bring it with a heart to bless others. You know, I would say that everyone is on a pilgrimage. Everyone. And we're seeking to encounter people like ourselves. And in that, probably the greatest need is to be loved. Yet, how often we pass by one another without noticing, without stopping, without the slightest sign of recognition. Slightest sign. And that's why we continue to frantically search for the one who will love us. And in our society, that frantic search takes a lot of different forms. Many of them not healthy. Underpinning that search is the search for God, because these qualities that we look for in other people, this love, is the love of God that's being expressed in our own behavior, because we are made in the image and likeness of God. So I would say to you, if God isn't easily, that he isn't easily found if he isn't reflected in the eyes of other people. Yes, there have been times that are recorded where a saint or a mystic had an experience of God that was separate from other people. I'm not saying that that can't happen. What I am saying is that for most of us, it happens in relationship to other people. I was very touched by, it's so funny because I realized that your video of, that you just went, it just went up of your parish. I was so touched by the fact that that's what was said over and over and over again, was the warmth and the welcome that is associated with coming to this parish and becoming a member of this parish. And may it grow and blossom, because that's what people are going to touch. That's what they're going to see. It's not the church building. You can have the prettiest building in the world. I'm going to speak more about that in a little bit. Everybody needs a token of friendship and love, even if it's a smile or a nod of the head. You know, my job at the monastery, one of them is to answer the telephone all day. It's a great job. I also do a lot of the business of the monastery. And I've made it a practice that when I call to order something or to ask something, I start, usually people say, this is Eileen, this is Mary, you know, they're introducing themselves. And I make a point of stopping the whole conversation and saying, good morning, Eileen, how are you today? Well, the reason I do that is because probably very few people are going to ask her that question, so that she becomes a person and not, you know, a voice prompt. We get those too, and they're not worth asking how they are any more than the little computer thing at the checkout for parking at the airport, you know, it talks to you like a person. You don't have to be particularly polite. I don't think it would notice. But these kinds of recognitions are very small, but they're very important. If you do that at the deli, and you do that at the gas station, and you do that, you know, in all the little places that you go, people feel recognized, and it can change their day. It can really change their day. Yes, sometimes this kind of open-heartedness, this welcome, does require more time. Sometimes people need us to be more available to them. And that's important. It's very important. But that's not typical of hospitality. There are many more times where extraordinary amounts of our time are not required of us. And you know, our age, if it has anything to say for itself, is that it is extraordinarily lonely. Extraordinarily lonely. A lot of that has to do with technology, of putting, you know, the phone to text, or the laptop, or whatever, in ahead of a personal relationship. You know, people say extraordinarily personal things on Facebook that they probably should not, and would not if you were standing next to them or sitting with them having a coffee. It just kind of pours out. And some of that has to do with loneliness, of not having another place to seek that out, to get that kind of relationship. And how sad is that? You know, am I condemning Facebook? No more than I have condemned anything this morning, or from this morning's talk. It has its place. I think it's fantastic that, you know, if your family lives across the country, you can see what your nephew or your grandson or whoever, how they did at their soccer game. I mean, that's cool. I mean, it just creates more connectedness, but not when we use it to fulfill the loneliness that we have in our lives. And I think young people are learning to do that more and more, and it really frightens me, because they're not learning to have conversations. They're having monologues with a Facebook page. Anyway, we have to begin to give this hospitality of heart, to share ourselves in friendship that's rooted in our Christian faith, and to cultivate this environment of honoring one another. You know, there are difficulties associated with hospitality, and I want to look at just some of them with you. First of all, there's all the pressures of society. Our society places a high value on control, on planning, on being efficient, on multitasking. You know, multitasking is a really serious problem. I can't tell you the number of times that I've seen a child come up to, and I've seen it, child come up to a parent, and the parent just brushes them off because they're involved in something else. That's an example of a horrific multitasking. And we'll talk about why in a little bit. But multitasking, by and large, although we honor it in our culture, is really not to be honored. Because the more you multitask, the less you can devote to being aware and mindful. You can't. You can only do a certain number of things at a time. You can't be aware and mindful of yourself, your environment, or anything when you're doing many things at one time. And there's been scientific studies about that too, about how the quality of what we do diminishes based on how much we multitask. Our society likes measurable results and completed tasks. We are highly rewarded when we can measure what we've accomplished and when we get something done. And the problem with hospitality is it's hard to quantify what's been done, and the work of hospitality is never finished. So it creates a real disquiet in us when we look at doing it. We let the culture of home makeovers and gourmet cooking pressure us into being fabulous hosts. You know, back to New York for a moment, Martha Stewart wasn't around. our grandparents and great-grandparents, they knew a lot about hospitality, a lot. And they knew a lot about cooking, and they knew a lot about making you loved and comfortable. They weren't worried about what the latest trends were. It was the furthest thing from their mind. They wouldn't even consider that it existed. And yet we have this, in many cases, a party store mentality, where as a host, we're totally caught up in all the details. This can even happen at church. I'm not saying it happens here because I don't know your church, but I know churches where hospitality gets limited to hosting the coffee hour, to being the greeter and just saying hello when new people come, to serving meals. Is there anything wrong with any of those things? Absolutely not. They're essential and they're wonderful. But if that's where it begins and ends, that's a problem. That's a problem. So when we focus on these demands of being the host, preparing, putting the best foot forward to make a good impression, it's kind of like we're living that when everything is just right, the perfect people come together for the perfect event. And that's how a lot of life is, that's how a lot of life is lived right now. If we can't do it perfectly, we're not going to do it. So as a host, we control who comes, what is shared, and when. And among all the pressures on the host to arrange everything perfectly, the needs of the guests are kind of there in the background. The focus is on us, on doing it the right way, the best way. The problem with this, among others, one problem certainly is that it becomes self-draining. You really get exhausted very quickly because it doesn't get replenished. You're putting out and putting out and putting out. And without any return, you're refreshing or nourishing only the person that you're offering the hospitality to, and you can't keep it up very long. And of course, there's the problem of time. We talked about that this morning. We're all over busy. And we struggle and we wear out, we struggle with our limits and we get worn out. And we feel like hospitality can't be just one more thing that's added to everything else that we do. It's just like the straw that broke the camel's back. And so we immediately set it aside. I would say to you that we really need a change of perspective. We need to correct and broaden our view of what hospitality is. And the first thing is, it's not just self-emptying. It's not. As a host, the hospitality we offer should be coming from a grateful heart. From a grateful heart. We have so many things to be grateful for to God for. And this hospitality then becomes a response of love and gratitude for all the love and welcome that God has given us. And we have the reward of becoming more Christ-like and more united to Him. But what about as a guest? When we're at home in another person's heart, when we touch love, the love of a brother and sister in Christ, and feel recognized, and are treated like a neighbor, we come closer to understanding what God's love is. So we both reflect it as a host and receive it as a guest. And there's an interesting way that these things work together. I mentioned my mother Lillian, and I'm going to use her as an example, and I think she's in heaven now, God willing, and I don't think she'll mind. But my mother was terribly gracious when we were with people, and she'd say, oh, come by anytime, come by anytime. And I think she meant it when she said it. But when they called and said they were coming or the doorbell rang, she'd go, like, why are they here? Because there was a disconnect between the desire for them to be there and the inconvenience of them actually coming. And yet, I can say to you that even at the monastery, I told you I answer the phone. And, you know, that's not always convenient. It's not part of the multitasking that's on my agenda often. And sometimes when the phone rings, I'm really known to look at the phone itself and go, what? Just what? You know, you feel so irritated. I try not to do that when I answer the phone. I get it out of the way when I'm talking to the phone itself. But you do have that kind of irritation, like, what? You're interrupting what's important. And yet I can't tell you the number of occasions where that or answering the doorbell for somebody who's unexpected, which happens a lot at the monastery, we welcome people to come anytime. We really do. And we have, I'm not one of them generally, we have a couple sisters, that's part of their day's work. No matter what's going on, they answer that doorbell and they treat that guest with welcome. And you know, even when it's irritating and when it's not something you want to do, there are so many times when there's a gift to you in it. I just can't even tell you. And sometimes it's the more angry that I am and I have to interrupt, that, you know, I'm taking a call from somebody who really needs something. It's not, you know, one of those robocalls or whatever. Who really needs a listening ear. Who's, what they have to tell me gives me a reflection of Christ in a way that I never would have dreamt possible. And that happens with guests coming a whole lot. You know, it's tremendously edifying when people share their burdens with you and you can see how incredibly you are blessed by being in their presence. And I think that that's something that we don't give enough credit to, this idea that there are inherent blessings for us when we extend ourselves. We can experience the joy of leaving people better than we found them. The book of Proverbs says the generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters will himself be watered. So practicing hospitality in this dual way of seeing yourself both as a host and a guest shifts the understanding from the host who is in control to the Holy Spirit who can guide and direct willing partners. Again, it's opening to God. It's not being in a closed system where you're the center. When you're mindful, as we said this morning, when you're mindful and aware, God has an opportunity to be present in whatever you're doing. So this transformation gives a new image to hospitality, moving beyond, you know, the typical images of serving in church kitchens or basements or whatever, and replaces the burden and the lack of joy that we often feel, and changes our hearts so that we can give more to other people. And it's a seamless thing. It's, you know, I've made it sound like it's steps. It's not steps. You know, you open yourself to God, to awareness, to being mindful, and then things start to happen. And they take on a life of their own. But in order for this to happen, we have to do some things. And I like to call it making ready. First of all, making room, making ready, and being available. Well, what does it mean to make room? Well, it begins to be by being mentally, emotionally, and spiritually there for the other person. So it actually takes the cultivation of mindfulness and awareness that we spoke of earlier. You can't be frenzied, running off in a thousand directions, having no sense of what priorities are, what God would like them to be, let alone what you would like them to be, and be hospitable. You have to be more in touch. So it involves kind of doing a mental checklist when you get up in the morning. And I really think this is important. Yes, we need to get in touch with God for sure in the morning. We need to get our day oriented that way. But we all know that as people, we wake up in a mood, right? A mood is, it's not the right word for it, but the day starts and you might have a headache. You may feel like a bear or grouchy. You may feel like you just want to stop the world and want to get off. You want people this far away from you. Now there's the good side. I'm pointing out some of the difficulties. And when you feel like that, the first thing you need to do is be aware of that. And if you go back to the image of a parent who's interrupted, I see nothing wrong and everything right with saying to a child, you know, I'm not in a place where I can listen right now to you. Now you can't say that to a wife, she's tiny, but you can say that to a child that's, you know, by the time they're school age. Mommy can't listen right now. What that does is it lets the child know they're not doing anything wrong. The problem isn't them, it's you. Whether it's the bad mood or the busyness, whatever is behind it. But it really does take being mindful to know that that's what the problem is. And it takes a lot of maturity and a lot of work to get to that point. It sounds really easy, and it is not. Most of us grow up having the capacity to wear on our sleeve whatever we're feeling. Some of us are better at hiding it than others, but it'll creep out in different ways. We all have that problem. So we all need a way to handle it. And I would say you need to be honest with yourself and acknowledge where you're at from the time you open your eyes in the morning. And then take steps to mitigate it. Maybe ask God's help more. Maybe take a little bit more quiet time during the day to get yourself a little more in order, aligned. Maybe more self-care is in order. Maybe the reason you feel like that is because you're overloaded. Whatever it is, you need to just take stock of it. And be aware of how it affects your ability to offer hospitality, to open yourself to another person. You know, this is a minor point, but I will make it nonetheless by using the Shunammite woman as an example. She was described as well-to-do in scripture, obviously well-to-do enough that she could, you know, create a guest room, if you will, for the prophet. She does make that room. And apparently, from the story, she doesn't really have any selfish motives about it. She's not doing it because she expects something in return. And I would say to you that we need to be aware of that in the back of our minds. We need to be clear with ourselves when we are doing something because we expect something in return. And sometimes when we're clear with ourselves about that, it enables us to be clear with the person we're dealing with. You know, it's kind of like fundraising. You know, if you're going to go to somebody, you want them to help you with some project, yeah, you can go and, you know, compliment their home and try to be relaxed, but the underlying thing is that you're there to ask for money. There's nothing wrong with saying, I'm really enjoying being with you, but let me tell you what my real thing is. We have this project and we'd like you to be a patron. It puts everybody at ease because the underlying issue is out in the open. And that's a minor thing about hospitality, but it is something nonetheless to be mindful of. When we look at making ready, we have to know that hospitality is relationship building. So we want to know how it's best offered for that person with compassion, with empathy, viewed not as a personal draining, giving, whatever, but an expectation to receive as well. And that takes a lot of humility. Most of us feel pretty good when we can offer something. You know, you kind of, I did good, you know, I offered something. But you look, trying to look and see what you receive from that person does take a lot of humility because it's often something quite small, but something very important. So it's a mutual exchange. A mutual exchange in which the Holy Spirit is involved. And sometimes it's a calling to mind of who is our guest. Again, not in the Martha Stewart sense, but in the sense of who's coming into our life, how we're connected, what their needs are, what more could we do to show them hospitality, to acknowledge them, to be responsive to them, and how do we get more properly prepared. And the most difficult thing is probably the being available section, because it takes time to be available. It's possible to say yes and then never do anything. We talked about that this morning. Or say that we're going to do it at a later time. And we know that hospitality is often unexpected and unpredictable, just like when that phone rings at the monastery, or when a family of five shows up, and it's right before lunch, and we're going to offer for them to stay, and the sister's going to show them around and spend the afternoon with them. It's unexpected, and we all have that in our lives. All have that. It can be as something as simple as your whole day is planned, and someone whom you know calls you, and they have an emergency. They need to talk to you. And it means, what are you going to do with that? You have your day planned. They have a need. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So taking action is essential to hospitality. But remember that from the example of Martha and Mary, Martha's example that being a, Mary's example was that being available is not always about being busy. Being available means being present at times. And that's an important distinction to make. Just because we're busy doesn't mean we're necessarily being hospitable to other people, taking them into our lives. And I would say to you, you know, I have to admit to you, I had beautiful little cards that I made to give each one of you so that you remember the two things I'm about to say, and they're at home on my desk. I was humiliated this morning when I went through my things. I said, where are they? Well, they must be in Elwood City because I can't find them. Very humbling. I've never done that before. Thank you, Lord. But the two of the main points that I would like to make are, one, what you do matters. It matters. What you do matters, but not much. What you are matters tremendously. What you do matters, but not much. What you are matters tremendously. And in that little phrase, you get a deep understanding of exactly what I'm talking about, because who you are is reflected in how you offer hospitality, how you are with other people. And the second thing corollary to that is, with the gift of listening comes the gift of healing. With the gift of listening comes the gift of healing. How often we really aren't listened to, and how much healing comes from when we are. We know that when we have need of professional counselors. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that hospitality is going to take care of the need for professional listening. But we do know that that kind of listening is incredibly powerful. What we don't know is how much that listening could affect people if we only took it on. You don't need a degree in counseling, social work, in psychology to be a listener. You need to be a Christian living a Christian life to be a listener. But it requires that whole thing again of time management. We need to take charge of what occupies our time, as we looked at this morning. Consciously making decisions and not letting things just happen to us. We need to rethink and reshape our priorities. And can you see how circular this is? It's all of a piece. If we want to know how to shape and rethink our priorities, who do we look at? We look at Christ. That was such a powerful thing this morning. When I read it, it's not mine. None of this is mine. It's all in my own words, but I'm no great thinker. But how powerful is it that Jesus' priorities and the relationships he had were shaped by the time he had with his Father? They were not shaped by him sitting down and making lists and doing checkoffs and trying to decide by himself. And it's a mystery. How did he know from talking with the Father? We don't know that any more than we're going to know how God's going to communicate that to us. But we have to give him the chance. We have to give him the chance. Or there's really no hope, because you can't sit down and do what I'm talking about here. Listen so that it's healing. And knowing that what you are matters more than what you do. You can't do that on your own. That has to be done in concert with Christ, with the Father. So it's all very circular. But I can tell you about something that I learned of some years ago and had a great impact on my life. It's called the duty of the moment. The duty of the moment. There's an interesting quote here. We're so busy these days, it's as if we're on a merry-go-round or a roller coaster. Faster, 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 that's us. We don't know if we're going forward, backward, or which way. So here we are, living in a world that goes on all around us, more selfish, more greedy, more horrible than before. Faster and faster and faster. But Christ said, I've come to serve, and so should we. Christ said, pray always. We should also. But how? How do we live in this world today? How do we serve? Well, the answer is the duty of the moment. The duty of the moment is what you should be doing at any given time in whatever place God has put you. Very, very, very important point. You know, Mother Christophora loves to tell the story of a woman who came to the monastery, very enamored of monastic life. She just thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And she asked her to talk to Mother, and she sat down and she said, I think I have a calling to be a nun. Mother said, okay, great. Tell me about yourself. I'm married. I have 4 kids. Like, excuse me. Like, what is your duty of the moment? Your life wasn't a mistake until you came to the monastery that day and God suddenly showed you what you should do. You know, we can identify where we are as the duty of our current moment. And again, that kind of supplants this idea of living either in the past or in the future. Because this lady left and said, well, when the kids are all grown, I'll be back. So if you have a child, your duty of the moment may be to change a dirty diaper. If you have a house to clean, it may be to clean your house. If you're at work, it's to focus on what that work is and not what you're going to be doing, you know, hours from then. It's to be attentive and mindful to what is before you. It's not as though God has bigger plans than what you have at the moment, because you don't know if you're going to have any more moments. We act like we do. We live like we're going to live forever. And the only time we're caught up short is when somebody that we know or that we know of suddenly has their life snatched from them in a very unexpected way. Then we go, oh my gosh, he didn't get the next moment or the next day. It was finished. So this moment is very important. This moment for me is talking with you. And quite frankly, this moment for you is listening to me, no matter how painful that may be. And if you can't be in the moment, then you're free to get up and go. But if you're going to be in the moment, then you're stuck with me. You know, living in the duty of the moment has another important aspect, and that is you just don't do it to get through. You do it the best that you can for the love of God, so that everything you touch becomes sanctified. You know, the word to sanctify, that means to set apart for holy use. And I would say to you that anything we touch, if we're living in mindfulness, awareness, and connectedness to God, needs to be done with godly attention and godly love. And that is where we all fall so far short. It's hard. It's not easy. You're not going to leave here just because you've heard it and suddenly be able to do it. But it should be the goal of what we live, the goal of what we live. So that if you're changing the diaper, you're doing it because you are mindfully aware that you love the child and that this is a need. You know, when I was a social worker and I was sitting with families, you know, it was because I wanted to show them honor and respect and model it for them, for themselves to live out. But I was doing it at that moment with as much attention as I can bring. So it's doing little things well for the love of God. In the daily, routine, ordinary life of whatever is before us. And it's out of that that we can, it's a kind of a romanticized way to say it, but I do like it, uncover the face of Christ for other people. We've all met people that are very, they're rare, but they do exist. People that you know are being mindful that they're doing something with care. And it can be something as simple as, you know, going to a public restroom and watching the woman who's cleaning it. And she's doing it with attention. We're not talking about necessarily great things. Sometimes they're great things that we're asked to do, but more often than not, they're not. They're not. But to get in the habit of knowing that everything we do matters. That there isn't this hierarchy of what's important and everything else is kind of just something that you live through. It isn't. It needs to be sanctified and it needs to be offered not just to Christ but to the world that's so hungry for it. And we have big examples. You know, when you read literature, you hear about the father who drives through the night to bail out his addicted son from jail. Or the mom who spends day after day with a disabled child, spoon-feeding. The priest's wife who, you know, keeps her exhausted husband from falling apart. These are all the unsung heroes, you know, big things. But it's the attention to little things day after day after day after day that's so critical. And there's very little thrill or romance involved in it. There really isn't. You know, when it's the 18th diaper of the day, I would venture, never having had a child, but having been a pediatric nurse, I don't think that there's anything romantic or thrilling about it. There just isn't. The prophet Micah says, and I love this quote, many of you probably know it, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy," that's that mercy is the translation from the Hebrew of the word chesed, "and to walk humbly with your God." To act justly, to love mercy, steadfast love, compassion, empathy, all those things, and to walk humbly with your God. So God, in the very beginning, spelled out his holy and loving character toward Israel and called Israel to the same kind of holy living and loving toward him and toward their neighbors. And that's what we're called to do. Love one another as I have loved you. This is kind of what that looks like. This is what it looks like. And it's very small and it's very tough. It's really, really hard. Can you see how our relationships with others grow directly out of the mindfulness and awareness that we spoke of? It's so interconnected. And can you see that when we grow in this mindfulness, we grow in our relationship to Christ? We can't do it alone. It's going to fail. And then we're going to get into all those negative things that were on the list this morning. And I guess I would just like to close with a quote that I love very much. "Cast yourself into the arms of God and be very sure that if he wants anything of you, He will lift you for the work and give you the strength. Short, to the point, nice after lunch talk. Too hard to listen to long things after lunch. I hated being the only speaker after lunch. But I hope that gives you something to chew on, something to think about in terms of how important all the little things are that we're called to do. Because we're all called to great things, but they're usually quite little. Does anybody have anything that they want to say about this?
Yeah, I had a question. As I have my own answer as a priest to how this works, but in the average life of a people, you find that as a priest, obviously people come to me for confession, and I kind of attract an attention which people want to talk about their issues, which is fine. That's part of my vocation. However, there's a lot of people who naturally attract that or in life. How do you deal with all this stuff that people dump on you? You know, as nuns, I'm sure you have in the monastery, you have these profound, tragic stories and things where you obviously can't do anything for them, even if you could, you couldn't really. What is a good way to kind of deal with those in our own hearts and our own prayer life?
I think the first thing for me anyway is to remember that with listening comes healing. So that when I'm feeling impotent, that I can't offer someone a solution, I can be very aware that my listening can have an extraordinary impact. They may have had no one else listen to them in quite the way that I'm trying to do it. That's one thing. The other thing is we need to engage in self-care. When I leave a particularly intense meeting with someone, I try to do a couple of things. One, give it to God in one sentence. I can't carry this, it's too much for me. Sometimes it's to write a note on the board that says, pray for this person, two lines, what it is they need. If I need more than that, I may seek out one of the other nuns or Mother Cristofora and just say what it is that's difficult for me. But beyond everything else, I have to have a repertoire of how I'm going to take care of myself. I'm going to shock you. Sometimes it's watching an HGTV show. I'm serious. We have to know what it is that's going to take us out of the arena that we can't, that if we stayed in it, it would be more than we can bear. I don't do that all the time, but I have done it. Sometimes it's going for a walk. It can be anything. It could be taking a nap. But you have to know what it is that you need that's going to refresh you. Just like we talked about this morning, you know, you have to be aware of who you are and what you need in your prayer life. It's the same thing in your relationship with other people. And you need to do that without guilt. Without guilt. There are no shoulds in this. You know, what good would it do for me to say I should be able to move right back into the mainstream of life and start interacting with the sisters and, you know, have everything be glossy? It's a lie. Because often enough when I'm spent, the other people don't know why I'm feeling, why I'm perhaps being short with them or inattentive with them. So it's not kind to other people. It's not self-care, taking care of myself, and it's also a lie to say that you can take care of other people when you're spent. And that takes humility. It really does. It takes humility to know when to say, I have done what I can do, I need to be refueled. And it can take lots of forms. That's why people come to the monastery. Sometimes they need more than an HGTV show or PBS special. They're going to need a little bit more time. So we invite people, families, couples, individuals, to come to the monastery, to take their soul on vacation the way that they take the rest of themselves on vacation. When you come to the monastery, I'm just going to give a little PR about it, since some of you don't know monasteries. In our monastery, We have two guest houses. One has 4 bedrooms, one has 3 bedrooms. And when you come, if you come as a family, you're given a whole house. If you come as a couple, you for sure are given your own room and bathroom. You may share a house, in other words, with another couple. Each house has a living room, a dining room, a kitchen, comfortable furnishings. Your meals are all provided. Breakfast is in the guest house, lunch is with the nuns, and supper is given you to take home. You don't have to cook. And sometimes that's huge for women that come, and that's their daily drudge, just have somebody else make them a meal. You have the opportunity to walk the grounds when the weather's good, 100 acres, trails in the woods. We love having kids. We love having little kids. Our church is like this, only no chairs in the center, so you can imagine it's an arena for little kids. They love it. And we invite them to participate in the service as they're able. And I would say to you, it's only an hour and a half flight. You won't have to worry about the airport at the other end. We pick people up and take them back. And think about it as you are able to make a little pilgrimage for yourself. It is very restorative. And it has little to do with the nuns, more to do with God and being open and available to Him. So that's the extreme of self-care. It's a wonderful self-care, but we need the whole range of ways to take care of ourselves.
Just going back to the struggle of listening, say, do you think there's ever a time where you cut someone off? I've been listening, but...
You mean in one session or repeated sessions, or both?
I guess it would mean, like someone, I'm thinking of a particular situation, mm-hmm. Someone who's had a lifelong friend, and it's just that relationship has just been wrecking them. And, you know, the decision was made just to, I just can't be with you anymore.
Oh, okay.
You know? In terms of self-care, is that...
That's a really important point that you raised, Father Deacon, because it's probably one of the most difficult things in relationships beyond knowing what your limits are and when you're spent. It's discerning what real loving is, and that's not always easy. Sometimes a relationship can be non-loving to let it continue. I know that sounds like, what is she talking about? Well, how can I explain it to you? Okay, I'm going to take it out of the realm of friendships for a minute and move it to maybe a more comfortable spot. When I used to see clients for counseling, and we'd be working together for a while, and they would be coming and talking about their problems, and they were pretty much the same problems every time they came. I'm thinking of one couple that I saw that were having some pretty serious marital struggles. And no matter what we worked on and no matter what we talked about doing, they never did it. They just brought their problem back to me. And I finally said to them, you know, Karen and Steve, I think you ought to have a little ceremony at home. Just take the money that you're giving to me and flush it down the toilet. Because we're accomplishing nothing here. And so what I'm saying to you, that was a lot of years ago, and I don't know that I would say it the same way now. But I can say to you that sometimes confrontation is important in relationships. And it has to grow out of not anger and not a sense of misuse, but again, that listening spirit that you have. It's hard to do those things. Sometimes it's easier to stay in a difficult situation than it is to move out of it, even when the loving thing is to move out of it. I would also say to you on another level, if somebody comes to the monastery and we've talked and it's an hour and 45 minutes or something, much longer than I usually have the capacity to listen well to, I will say to them, you know, I know what you're saying is important. I can't listen anymore. I can't listen anymore right now. Sometimes it's because I have to go to church. Sometimes it's just because I can't, you know, you've overwhelmed me with what you've said, and I know it's important and I care about you, but I'm at the end of what I can listen to right now. Nothing wrong with that. Everything right about that. Because to let someone else feel your irritation is misconstrued. They don't know what you're irritated at. They don't know if you've judged them for what they've told you, or if they're a bad person, or whatever. But if you can say what your limitations are, then it's clear. It's hard to do because we don't like saying what our limitations are. We like to be able to do everything and do it well for as long as we need to. So honesty is important, and discernment is very important. And in that kind of situation that you raised, Father Deacon, that's probably a situation that needs to go to counseling. Because if it's been long-term, very long-term, there are reasons why both people have stayed in it. And sometimes in order to move out, you need help to figure out exactly how you got yourself into that and how to get untangled. So it isn't always clear. It isn't always something that you can do alone. So it's again, a whole spectrum of things. It's a whole spectrum of continuum, not a spectrum of how you intervene, something very simple to something very complex. Does that answer what you asked?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to have spring in Georgia.